Hi, I'm Robin Clare with Tributaries. Today we continue and conclude our talk with Simon Buxton, author of The Shamanic Way of the Bee. His is a fascinating initiation into a very ancient tradition which integrates the life of the bee into a highly conscious shamanic way. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, it's particularly fascinating, I think, for Europeans, because one of the things that I think many people who work within shamanic traditions in Europe, other than in, say, Siberia or Lapland, is that they say quite accurately that there's no evidence of us having had drums over here. And it's such a universal tool these days for people practicing shamanism. But where are our drums? Where are the British drums, the Irish drums? Those people who are listening to know about the Irish baran, actually, that's a very, very young instrument. It's not an ancient instrument. So to date, there's no archaeological evidence that drums have ever been used by our British ancestors for shamanic work, even within archaeological digs where you'd expect to find them. But within the path of pollen, that's where we find the British and European drum. And it's known as a tanging quoit. And a tanging quoit is a drum made of metal. The bee shaman has used the tanging quoit for, well, you know, it's always a difficult question for how long. Let's say if you go back far enough and when history slips into being myth, let's say. The idea of tanging is actually quite well known within beekeeping itself. If you were to talk to a modern-day beekeeper and you would say, what is tanging? They will say, oh, well, tanging's just some superstitious nonsense where you pick up a saucepan and you bang it and the bees will land on a particular branch if they've swarmed. And it's a classic example of something that has, as it were, leaked out of the path of pollen and is actually based on a real activity based on real principle that tanging was never done for the sake of the bees. Tanging was done for the benefit of the bee shaman. So the bee shaman would pick up this tool, this metal drum, and would begin to beat it. And they would beat it at a particular tempo, which is typically 4 to 7 beats a second. And that would then put them into an altered state of consciousness. You know, I spoke earlier about how the bee shamans were the first scientists. They understood that if you beat a drum at a particular rhythm, it affected your state of consciousness. Well, the bee shamans, like shamans the rest of the world, also arrived at that knowing. So the tanging puts the bee shaman into a state of consciousness that allows him or her to commune with the hive. So that tool is also used very commonly and was, of course, used within the initiation process.
Now, a signature of the bee's intelligence certainly is the hexagonal hive.
Yeah.
And that just has its place all over nature and certainly in architecture it's been picked up on.
Yeah. Very right. I mean, the hexagon is enormously significant for a variety of reasons, and therefore the number 6 is considered to be most potent number. Technically, within the bee tradition, it's actually called the hexagramma mysticum, which simply means the mystical hexagon. And I mean, if we consider the geometrical exactitude required to make a shape that where no empty space exists between one shape and another, there is none other in the known universe that is as accurate as the hexagon, where all space is utilized in full, where literally no gaps can arise. And I mean, that says something about the way that the path of pollen functions in terms of its community. But the hexagon is, it's a symbol that represents kind of perfect equilibrium, if you like. It's got extraordinary physical efficiency, and it actually curiously mirrors what will be common to many people listening to this, which is the makeup of a quartz crystal. I mean, across the world, you know, six-sided quartz crystals that terminate at a single point have been used within many shamanic traditions. And actually, they are a mirror of the bee cell. And the forces within the earth create these hexagonal crystals. And curiously, these crystals are actually contained within every human being. In fact, the human being is actually full of quartz, but it's in a fluid form. So our life is actually dependent on the fact that the body continuously wants to form six-sided crystals from this fluid that is flowing around the body. So we as human beings have this curious communion with the hexagon within our organism. So we have a kind of natural resonance with the hexagon of the bee. And this is one of the reasons why there is considered to be a relationship by bee shamans between the bee and the human being. The fact that we both respond on a cellular level to the hexagon. It's within us, and it drives and creates the flight of the bee.
Now, in saying that, wouldn't other animals as well? I don't know. I'm just curious.
Well, I'm not a biologist, so okay. So I don't. I simply don't know that.
Okay.
You'd need to ask a biologist.
Okay, I'll do that at some point. Look out, biologists.
Right. Robin's coming.
So I've got some great curiosities about what you term as the golden coins. Now, this is speaking about the pollen itself. Is that true?
Yes.
And you mentioned the royal jelly, but the pollen is, it's an amazing superfood. And to what do you attribute this?
Well, it's curious because I, within my initiation, it involved a period of nearly a month immediately thereafter, when actually I lived on pollen and water alone, occasionally with a small amount of honey. And the way that my teacher taught me was to sample pollen from a completely different point of view to begin to try and gain an insight into its gifts. I mean, on one level, you know, nutritionally, it's all pretty common stuff in terms of really what pollen brings. You know, it's very rich in amino acids and proteins, and it helps to suppress appetite, and it's used for treating prostate problems, and it's a great energizer of the body, and it can boost the immune system, and so on and so forth. These things are fairly well known, and I have to say that I'm not a nutritionalist, so those particular areas aren't as interesting to me as the aspects of what the bee tradition has to say about pollen and what it brings. Now, from that point of view, so let's go beyond the nutritional values, which are very commonly found and well known these days. From a shamanic point of view, the flower itself, all flowers, are considered to be the lover of the bee, and so she goes as a bride, if you like. I mean, I should just say that bees, the worker bees, are all female. So the bees who collect the pollen are female. And the bee kind of makes love to the flower. What the bee profits from most is that it derives its sustenance from the very parts of the plant that are pervaded by the plant's sexual energy. So the bee goes into the flower and sucks and collects the nourishment, and that's the pollen and the nectar, from the very parts of the plant that are steeped in sexual power. In other words, the flower's reproductive organs. So the bee then brings this sexual power from what we would call the visible face of spirit. That's another term for nature. It's a poetic way of saying nature. From the visible face of spirit to the hive. And this power, this sexual power that is a gift from the plant, is actually known as vitamin P. And vitamin, of course, listeners will know, vitamin is from Latin, from the word vita, which means life. And P, in this instance, stands for pan. So it's known as vitamin pan. Now, when I was first told this, I was kind of taken aback because I thought, well, what does Pan, who is the horned stag god of Europe, what could his connection be to pollen and the bees and sexual power and so on? And I later was informed and was that actually Pan is considered to be the guardian of the bees. And this is a very ancient tradition within Europe. So there is this link between between Pan, the guardianship of the bees, and sexual power. And it goes on from there as well, that Pan is himself considered to be a carrier of enormous power of sexuality and priapic potency. And his representative on Earth is the stag. So there's a relationship that is established by the bee shamans, not only with the bee, but also with the stag, through which he communes with the horned god Pan. And all of this revolves around the power of pollen, which is to do with the gift of sexual intoxication, which is one of the doorways, not the exclusive doorway, but is one of the doorways that is used to commune with the other world, with the parallel universe, with the separate reality.
Now, another topic that came up very interestingly is the whole way that the hive and the bees work together. I believe that men and women today have and have certainly always had traditional roles, and it is today that it almost seems like there is an energy to erase or merge male and female roles. And I'm wondering how you see this. I mean, the bees certainly have their system intact and have for so long. And in a way, I think this could be a good learning place for us.
Yeah, well, I have to agree with you. And I think that the path of pollen has got something really constructive to say about this, and it's mirrored right from the very beginning of when one steps into this work onwards, in as much as the bee master, who is the name of the male shaman teacher, he teaches one single male apprentice at a time, but he also has an opposite, and she is known as the bee mistress. And actually, she teaches six women at a time. And although the principles that are communicated to the men and the women are the same, there are certain teachings that are given only by the bee mistress to her own female students. And these women within the bee tradition are known as melissae, the melissae. And melissae is a term that's from ancient Greece. And it was adopted by these women. And if you look at your history, you'll discover that in ancient Greece, at the temple of Demeter and Aphrodite, who was also known as Melissa, by the way, the priestesses were called the Melissae, which simply translates as bees. Now, when I first started on this work, I was enormously intrigued by who these women were, because for a start, they were never seen ever without their veils. And their veils were ostensibly there to protect their eyes and their faces from the bees, but they also had a secondary function, which was to create a certain aura of mystery around them. So I would bombard my teacher with questions about these intriguing women, but he refused to shed much light on the matter, and it took me months to discover the most basic information about these enigmatic women. And of course, now I realize that this was all planned in advance. Finally, I turned around to him and I said, well, what on earth is the purpose of these women? Do they actually have one? I'd pretty much given up altogether.
Spoken like a true chauvinist.
I remember very, very clearly what he said. And he said simply that the knowledge of destiny and the ability to inspire are the two central powers of these women. And he went on to say that the knowledge of destiny is much more than folk magic. It's actually the innate knowledge of type. And it includes the ability to kind of educate and guide a type of person according to the sort of power that that type is meant to have. Well, that was pretty enigmatic to me. You know, I thought, well, what on earth is a type? And I assumed it was a sort of a form of personality or human behavior which might differ from person to person, and that somehow the Melissae could tune in to this in order to offer guidance and an instruction of some kind that was most suited to that individual person. Well, my teacher, the Bee Master, went on to say that the Melissae were women who lived in a country that was east of the sun and west of the moon, to which there was no known map. And he said that we, men, we are guests. We're just guests of the bee tradition. And that the Melissae are actually our hosts. The reason being, because bee society represents the very zenith of the feminine potency of nature. So in other words, we men are just the drones, and we'd better bloody remember that. Mm. Now, within the path of pollen, the teachings of masculinity and femininity are vitally important. And the bottom line is that the basics of masculinity and femininity haven't changed much for a million years or more. You know, the female consistently does more of the reproductive work, and the male is, I'm afraid, men listening out there, in many ways just a parasite on their partners. So women may well be the last thing to be civilized by men, and thank heavens. And my teacher would say, you know, these women, the Melissae, will never be civilized. And he went on to say that those who have fallen into their arms rarely do so without falling into their hands, as I was eventually to learn to my cost. And that was enough to send a sort of shiver down my spine and want to meet them desperately. But, you know, despite all of that, despite the drama of all of that, what I sensed was really being said was actually that the role of the bee master and the bee mistress and the connection between them, it wasn't based on who was the superior of the two. Both roles were distinct and of equal importance. And their functions, when taken together, performed a kind of corporate responsibility. So the Melissae, I mean, getting back to my colleagues, the female members of the Path of Pollen, they are considered to be the physical representation of an ancient sisterhood, which is known as the sisterhood of the hive. This is a universal term. And they are transmitters of an archaic impulse, which is central to the Path of Pollen. And Melissa, as a goddess, was a goddess of intoxication and sexual passion. And as I said, these are used as a doorway to a communion with all of life. And this is the impulse that the Melissae in the modern world continue to transmit. Now, when I first met the Melissae, I was just standing in the apiary, which is where the beehives were contained, and I was simply studying a single bee as it moved onto a flower. And this was one of the many instructions that my teacher gave me to hone my practice of observing and of entering the world of the bee so that I could understand their rituals and their energy. And I was so focused on this task that I hadn't noticed that one of these mysterious women had actually entered the orchard. And she very quietly made her way over to me. And then she whispered very lightly to me, is the flower the food of the bee, or is the bee the genitals of the flower? It's an interesting question. And that was my informal introduction to them, which says something about about what they're carrying and teaching. And I think I would like to say just a little bit more about this. The in terms of actually the type of women who tend to be drawn to this work, because they're considered to be one of two primary types. But what they have in common is that they are all fully empowered. Now, they're not empowered in the way that many women are in this day and age, which is kind of an attempt to regain power that was taken from them, which generally leads to them, to women imitating men. I mean, if we look at nature, you know, the sun and the moon don't compete. They're opposites. And the Melissae are said to fall into two distinct groupings, two primary types that are drawn to the work. And there is the maternal type and the magnetic type. And the Melissae incline to varying degrees to one or other of these extremes. So if she's of the maternal type, she'll ask very little save to fecundate her and to protect for her offspring. Now, that offspring might be a ritual, it might be a project, it might be a child. But if she's of the magnetic type and true to the law of her nature, she will deny herself no one who calls to her in the name of the tradition. Does that make sense?
It does, but it's a little vague in denying someone. What do you mean by that?
Maybe I can give this to you as a metaphor, because that may be more vague, or it may actually open it up. The path of pollen, the teachings are driven by a physicality, but they are often delivered in metaphor. So if we speak about these things in metaphor, we might say that there's one type of bee who moves from flower to flower, who sips nectar from one blossom to the next, picking up pollen from this bloom, and then she deposits it from one, she circulates pollen, and she fertilizes all the flowers. And as a result, the garden flourishes. And then back in the hive, she deposits the pollen-rich nectar into the communal vats, and which in the fullness of time will ripen into rich, dark, sweet honey. And this is considered to be a visible offering to the visible face of spirit. But then there's another type of bee who also moves from flower to flower, but doesn't sip nectar. Rather, she devours the blossom with all of her senses. So she inhales the fragrance and savors the taste and absorbs the color and so on. And she imbibes the joy of the song evoked by the sunlight on the petals and so on. And then back in the hive, she also shares the bounty with the community. And we might see the image of them gathering together, each bee dancing an expression of the blessings that she's gathered, dancing the joy and the splendor and so on. And one by one, all the bees will add their share to fill the cauldron in the center. And then they all dance together, encircling the cauldron and singing the praises of the visible face of spirit. And the resulting blend of this will also ripen and ferment into honey and is also rich and sweet, but to most people is utterly invisible. Now, that's the metaphor that was given to me. If I want to then flip back onto talking in more concrete terms, I would talk about the Melissae as being a metaphor for the hive itself. The Melissae uses her body as a means of producing particular nectars. And these nectars are liquids that are keys, that are strings on a celestial harp, that are gifts that induce certain states, including the gift of extended life. These nectars are produced by what we might call an endocrine alchemy. It's a That's really the best way I have of describing it, an endocrine alchemy. It's a kind of a what might otherwise be called a form of Western Tantra. Within the path of pollen, as well as having mapped out the meridians, they also mapped out what commonly in the Western world are called chakras. Now, within the path of pollen, the chakra is known as an interior star, otherwise known as the other term that we use is a wheel. By stimulating the interior stars, it releases liquids from particular endocrine glands into the body of the malissei, and those elixirs are then released from the malissei. So this is the these are the nectars that the malissei bring as a gift for the tradition itself.
What words of wisdom? I mean, obviously, all of this is one beautiful poetic metaphor for all of our lives and relates equally well. The poetics of it certainly equal the honey and sweetness and nourishment. But in a couple of sentences, what do you want to say to the beekeepers of the world who had no idea what was going on with this? Or maybe I'm totally naive, and of course they have an inkling.
Well, you know, my teacher used to talk about beekeepers as being linked strangers. And, of course, most beekeepers will have no connection with this tradition, and they have no need to have a connection with this tradition. They are the innocent beneficiaries of a way of life that brings about harmony and balance. I think probably rather than wanting to speak to the beekeepers who are listening, I'd be more inclined to speak to those people who are not beekeepers. Because if anything, I would adore it if my book inspired people to consider the possibility of stepping into the beautiful craft of the bee. In other words, to step into a relationship with our most ancient ally. The bottom line, Robin, is that the number of beekeepers in the world has diminished considerably.
Yes, very good point.
In Britain, just after the Second World War, there was something around 80 to 90,000 beekeepers, and now it's 30 to 40,000. Now, if we want to keep the world a fertile place, we need to have our bees. So for the future of our world, to keep it a fertile place for our children and our children's children, for the next seven generations and beyond, we need to step into the craft. So my invitation is to encourage people not just to imbibe the gifts of the hive, but also to consider having communion with humanity's most ancient ally, the sacred honeybee.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Such a wonderful story about some of the wonder in this world. Simon Buxton, shaman and author of The Shamanic Way of the Bee. Many thanks to everyone tuning in around the world and for helping out with donations to keep our presence alive and well. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and to sign up for our weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.